the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mohler is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. To get online with Dr. Mohler, call toll-free nationwide, 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Albert Mohler Program. Back in Louisville, Kentucky, back from the Southern Baptist Convention. Nashville is a different city today. Several thousand Southern Baptists left overnight and during the day as that convention came to an end. It's interesting just to ponder all the conventions taking place in America, not just denominational conventions, much less just Christian conventions. It's one of the biggest industries in this country, and it's just fascinating thing to reflect upon every once in a while, how many millions of people are headed to all these meetings at any time, ready only to go home and pack for the next meeting. Today we're going to be talking about the issue of sexual abstinence among singles and among teenagers, and especially about the cover story in this week's edition of Rolling Stone magazine, not found at your local Christian bookstore. Rolling Stone is one of the key periodicals that is produced by the counterculture. It really was very much a part of the drug culture and the rock culture of the 1960s. And right now, it's a way of looking at what is considered to be cool and interesting to cool people today, especially to the young. The cover of Rolling Stone magazine has actress Jessica Alba on the front. But here's one of the stories advertised: The New Virgin Army, Life Among the Young and the Sexless. Now, what makes this fascinating, folks, is that Rolling Stone considers sexual abstinence among young Christians to be one of the oddest and most bizarre things it has ever heard about. And I'm going to tell you about this news article in just a few minutes, but first, a review of other issues in the news. Yesterday came the long-awaited report having to do with the controversy at the Air Force Academy over what has been charged as religious intolerance. The report was released, and Lieutenant General Roger Brady, who is the Air Force Deputy Chief of Staff for Personnel, said that the investigation revealed that there was evidence of insensitivity, but no overt religious discrimination. Now, I think this report is very important. We've been tracking this controversy with you, and I've had grave concerns, and those concerns remain, that what we are seeing here is a secularist agenda that is being really forwarded and encouraged by the press and by others who want to suggest that Christians, in order to be tolerant, must either hide their Christianity or certainly withhold their Christian witness. That's the big issue here. The one central charge made against these evangelical cadets and faculty members and others at the Air Force Academy is that they were sharing their faith. They were seeking to lead others to know the Lord Jesus Christ, to evangelize. Now, the insensitivity that was cited in this report is something about which we all must be concerned. If there is any name-calling, if there is any misbehavior, we need to know about that. It needs to be confronted, not only with education, but with discipline where necessary. But the overt religious discrimination that others are charging, the intolerance that they're trying to label this, it really has to do with the right of evangelical cadets to exercise their own Christian convictions. Now, the New York Times is outraged by this. In its editorial, which was entitled Obfuscating Intolerance, the New York Times said that this report is simply something like an ostrich hiding its head in the sand. It's ignoring the obvious. The evangelical cadets, which are by the hundreds at the Air Force Academy, are identified by the New York Times as evangelical zealots. Zealots. Let's just remember the historical rootage of that term. It has to do with something like terrorism. And what did these young evangelical zealots do? They tried to share their faith with fellow cadets. They were encouraged to do so by an evangelical chaplain who was speaking to evangelical students during an evangelical worship service. I failed to see the problem. That sounds to me like America. A Jewish chaplain speaking to Jewish students in a Jewish service should be expected to talk about Jewish things, Jewish beliefs, Jewish practices, and to encourage Jewish students to be Jewish. Why, by the reference of sanity, should an evangelical chaplain not suggest that evangelical students should practice their evangelical faith in a way that is consistent and bold and courageous? Now, what's interesting is that the New York Times editorial said, quote, "This muddle," that is the report, "stands in stark contrast to an earlier investigation by Yale Divinity School that found widespread problems with intolerance at the academy," end quote. Well, as a girl I knew in college used to say, hang on, hold it. This makes no sense whatsoever. Number one, the Yale Divinity School did not conduct an official investigation of the Air Force Academy in these issues. Instead, a faculty member from Yale, along with other students, went to the Air Force Academy in order to study and to consult on the issue of sexual harassment. That's a very different issue. While there, these students, along with their professor, were outraged at what they saw as a display of overt evangelical faith. Well, sorry, Madam Professor and fellow students, that is the First Amendment at work. And, you know, this is just how the media begins to contort these things. And before long, you have the New York Times writing an editorial as if the Yale Divinity School has issued an official report castigating the Air Force Academy for religious intolerance. We'll be watching this with you. This controversy bears close watching because it's not over. By a voice vote yesterday, the House of Representatives ordered another investigation of this issue. It's hard to know how to address what I want to talk about next. Michael Schiavo, it is now revealed, has buried Terry Schiavo in Florida rather than in Philadelphia, where he had said he was going to bury her. But the real controversy is about the marker that he has placed over her grave. The marker indicates that Terry Schiavo, quote, departed this earth, end quote, on February 25, 1990. That's the date of her brain injury. And then it says she was allowed to be, quote, at peace only 15 years later. The date listed with at peace is March 31, 2005. Do you see the problem here? Terry Schiavo's death certificate says she died on March 31, 2005, not February 25, 1990. Mr. Schiavo's trying to rewrite history and rewrite medicine. And, of course, this is a moral message as well. This particular grave marker is an insult not only to Terry Schiavo, but to human dignity. It mixes medical and moral nonsense. Terry Schiavo's death certificate lists March 31, 2005 as her date of death, and until that date, she was not brain dead, nor was she legally or medically dead. She was not dead until she was dehydrated by court order. We should also note that this particular marker that was placed over her grave by Michael Schiavo is in direct contradiction with what he said in testimony back in 1992 when he was pursuing a medical malpractice suit on the basis of Terry's injury. He said this in his deposition, quote, I married my wife because I love her and I want to spend the rest of my life with her. Now, that is very strange language, spoken, of course, in the present tense, for one who now tells us that he even then considered his wife dead. In Massachusetts, there's yet another controversy over sex education. This is over the village of Shrewsbury, where the local schools conducted a youth risk behavior survey. It was given to students in grades 6, 8, 9, and 11. It was passed out in health courses. This youth risk behavior survey asked very explicit questions about sexual behavior, including oral sex, sexual intercourse, many other behaviors. They were asked when they first did it, how often they did it, if they used protection when they did it. Mark Fisher was outraged because his 12-year-old daughter was asked those questions. Mr. Fisher thinks it is totally inappropriate for 11 and 12-year-olds to be asked questions about overt sexual behavior. And I think most American parents would be in enthusiastic agreement with him. Now, all this is a reminder once again of some of what takes place in many school systems where there are surveys, presentations, and all kinds of messages that are addressed to our children without our knowledge, without parents having any involvement whatsoever. In some school districts, there have even been physical examinations with questions about sexual touching and all the rest to school children without the parents being aware. Mark Fisher said, thank God I found out about it in time and I opted out. By opting out, he means that he found out about it and he opted his child out from having to fill out the form. But the district's director of health and physical education, Patricia Dagon, said that the health advisory board had decided to eliminate all but two sexual questions for the younger children. Have you ever engaged in sexual intercourse and have you ever performed oral sex? I guess that's supposed to be considered an accommodation. I think most parents would see it as a continuing outrage. Folks, eternal and constant vigilance is what's called on That's parental responsibility. You've got to be aware of what's being passed out in class, the film strips being shown in class, the materials that are being passed around the classroom, the health education curriculum, and all the rest, because our children are the targets of a very clear message. Even to ask these questions in a survey is to raise to the consciousness of these children realities that parents ought to control. We'll be right back to talk about the issue of sexual abstinence and why the Rolling Stone, that is the magazine, finds it such a revolutionary, radical, and absolutely unprecedented phenomenon. You would think that evangelicals in 2005 had just come up with this idea. What are we thinking? We'll be back to talk about it. I'm Albert Mohler. Welcome back to the Albert Mohler Program. I don't know if you look at Rolling Stone magazine. It's actually not something I would suggest. I felt like when I picked it up, I needed to have it carried around in some kind of wrapper because of the cover. It's Jessica Alba, an actress of which I'm not familiar, but I can just tell you that it is a scantily clad Jessica Alba that is on the front of this issue of Rolling Stone magazine. That's not what interested me. It was the article underneath, entitled The New Virgin Army, Life Among the Young and the Sexless, that I thought might be interesting. And it certainly was. This article, which is in the very center of the magazine, introduces us to three young, 20-something young men, all evangelical Christians, some of them at least graduated from Pepperdine University in California. They're now studying and working in New York City. They're living the kind of metropolitan life that you associate with the fast lane. But they're practicing sexual abstinence, and they're serious about it. And Rolling Stone magazine finds this just absolutely incredible. Where did this tribe come from? Listen to this. They ask this. What if the true face of the Christian right is that of a 24-year-old religious studies graduate student at New York University? They say, what if it's not Jerry Falwell or Pat Robertson? They name that. That's the kind of face that Rolling Stone magazine associates with conservative Christianity. But what if it's not that kind of face, but instead it's a 24-year-old graduate student at New York University? They introduce us to Matt Dunbar, a young man. He is from California. He calls sex communion, and he declares himself a virgin. The reporter says this, chastity is a new organizing principle of the Christian right, built on the notion that virgins are among God's last loyal defenders, knights and ladies of a forgotten kingdom. Mr. Dunbar, this young 24-year-old man, says abstinence is countercultural. It's against materialism, consumerism, and the idea that anything can be bought or sold. The reporter goes on to explain that the elevation of virginity, especially for young men, as a way of understanding yourself and your place in the world, is new, it says here. He says it's also very old, going back to the first century of Christianity. But it's new, at least in terms of any recent point of reference. He goes on and says here it's a never-ending war and not one that can be fought alone, which is why virgins like Mr. Dunbar tend to travel in packs to church and to Bible studies, to parties, and et cetera. Now, there are other things going on here. Obviously, this magazine is just trying to figure out what's going on, why these young people are committing themselves to sexual abstinence. I mean, after all, that is hardly the message you're going to get walking through Times Square in New York City. That's hardly the message you're going to get turning on primetime television, much less going into the cinema. That's hardly the message you're going to get among their young 20-something peers, at least in the larger secular world. In the secular world, sex, premarital, extramarital, whatever, heterosexual, homosexual, just becoming the new circus. But not among these conservative young Christians who believe that sexual abstinence is not only some kind of hypothetical, theoretical goal, but is an actual expectation of our Creator. Now, this reporter goes on just trying to figure all this out. And there's some fascinating twists and turns in this story. The article looks at several books that are very popular among young people today, some of the books we've even discussed on this program. It comes back to the fact that these young men, and the focus is on young men in this article, are committed to sexual abstinence because they see it as a way of demonstrating a radical commitment to Jesus Christ, a radical commitment to Christianity. Now, Rolling Stone knows nothing other to do with this than to label that as evidence of the religious right coming up with a new program. Am I missing something here? Isn't this as old as the Bible? Certainly among Christians, isn't this as old as the apostles, as Jesus, as the New Testament? You see, your point of reference really does establish how you see reality. For Rolling Stone magazine, premarital sex, sex in almost any form, packaged in any kind of label, is simply normal. Not having sex, regardless of marriage or context, is just not normal. These are abnormal young Christian men. Why would they do this? Now, what must it have been like for these three guys to be interviewed by Rolling Stone magazine? There are very intimate details of their lives indicated here. Abstinence is a personal but also a public issue in this. They are accountable to each other. Interesting discussion about how that works and of the culture from which that has come. Listen to the end of the article. Like the fundamentalists of old, today's Christian conservatives define themselves as apart from the world, and yet the modern movement aims to enjoy its fruits. To the biblical austerity of chastity, they add the promise of mind-blowing sex using the very terms of the sexual revolution they rally against. In other words, these guys are not against sex. They just believe, now hold on to this, that sex is to be reserved for marriage. And they believe that in the institution of marriage, sex actually has a very important part. And they're not ashamed to say they're looking forward to it. But not now. Not before they say, I do. Not before they come into the institution of marriage and have this gift presented to them by the Creator in its proper frame and the authorization from their Creator to enjoy it and to anticipate it, even as they live right now. These young men are described as something like Christian knights. Their accountability process is something like a Christian equivalent to the round table. But here again, we face what I call the National Geographic factor. A secular journalist confronts a representation of bold and authentic Christianity and says, this is really weird. We had no idea this tribe existed. We must go back to headquarters and put out a cover story complete with photographs just to let people know that this tribe really lives. Deep in the jungle of Manhattan, there is found a group of primeval, tribal, Christian young men who are Christian knights committed to sexual abstinence. How do we explain it? Well, folks, how do we explain it? This movement about sexual abstinence, let's just say from the very get-go here, it's not new. But it sure sounds new to the ears of those who have never heard it before. And that includes not only those who are writing for Rolling Stone magazine, but quite frankly, some within the church who have never heard this message before, have never heard it clearly. Why do we believe in sexual abstinence before marriage? Why? That's the question. That's what we're going to talk about. Why do we believe this? And what do we believe about it? Is it optional? Is it mandatory? Is it expected? What are you teaching your own young people, your own children? I'd love to hear from some in this generation, some of the 20-somethings that are discussed in this article. I'd love to know about your commitment, how you got there, and why you think it's important. I'd love to hear from some of the young men like the young men profiled in this article. You're in your late teens, in your 20s, or in your 30s. You're single. You're not yet married. We've talked about that before, too. But for right now, let's just deal with this. You are committed to sexual abstinence. How do you explain that? What do you tell your peers? How did you get there? What keeps you there? Rolling Stone magazine juxtaposes this article with its cover story on Jessica Alba. And let me tell you, it's anything but a piece of consistent journalism when you look at this one double issue of Rolling Stone magazine. The cover story on Jessica Alba is really about sex, about how sexy and attractive she is and how she uses this because, as she says in this article, she knows young men and she knows what they're looking for, and that's what she delivers. She says this, most men love the crazy girl, and that's what she tries to be. She makes herself hot, she says, in order to attract male attention. That's exactly what the guys in this other article are trying to avoid. They talk about such things as bouncing the eyes and avoiding overt sexuality in order that they could keep their minds on Christ, their minds pure, and their commitment to sexual abstinence. Give us a call. The phone number is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. The issue is sexual abstinence. The particular focus of this article is young men, but I'd be glad to hear from young women as well. Why do we believe in sexual abstinence? Why does it matter? 877-893-8255 is the phone number, 877-893-TALK. From Louisville, Kentucky, this is the Albert Mohler Program.
listening to the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. To get online, call toll-free 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Or go to www.albertmohler.com. Here again is your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Welcome back, America. You know, one of the interesting things about the media is that it gives us a reflection of ourselves. At least in part, we get to see how others see us. And on an issue like sexual abstinence, we see how bizarre Christian teaching, Christian beliefs really sometimes appear to those who live by a very different worldview and live that out through a very different lifestyle. And this cover story in Rolling Stone magazine, the story on the new Virgin Army, looking at young Christian men who are committed to sexual abstinence, it's a mirror about evangelicalism. And I have to tell you, I think it serves a very positive cause for the gospel. I think the very fact that Rolling Stone and its editors and writers became interested in this is an indication that that the power of the gospel is really about something that even has attracted their interest. Let's go to Abe calling from Canton, Ohio, listening on WHKW. Abe, go right ahead. All right, we lost Abe. Let's go to Aaron calling from Louisville, Kentucky, listening on WFIA.
Hello, sir?
Yes, sir. Go right ahead, Aaron.
Oh, okay. I just thought I'd say my girlfriend and I have been together since August, and I guess I'm one of the guys that you described because we haven't held hands or kissed, not to try and brag or anything, but, like, I just thought that, and the conclusion that we came to was if we don't want to have sex before marriage, you kind of have to pull back really far as just young people that have, you know, emotions and passions that are fairly strong. Like, it's just hard to even put yourself close to that without getting really dangerous.
Okay, Aaron, I really appreciate that, and I think that very suggestion will help some folks in thinking this through. But let me ask you a radical question. Number one, why would you be concerned about this anyway? Where'd you get this idea?
Scripture, really. I mean, it's just...
That's a great answer, frankly, right there, Aaron. That's what I was looking for. You know, the Rolling Stone magazine writer seems to think somehow that the Christian movement just came up with this as a way of fighting the culture war, but you help us to remember there's more than that. Aaron, do you mind me asking how old you are?
I'm 22.
All right, great. Well, God bless you, Aaron, and I just pray the Lord will give you even greater resolve every day and also give you the desire of your heart and the young woman he's prepared for you for marriage and everything, every good thing he would give you. In the meantime, stay strong. Thanks so much for calling. Let's go to Michelle calling from Ontario, Canada, listening on XM Satellite Radio. Go right ahead, Michelle. Michelle, you there? All right, let's go to Ethan, calling from Louisville, Kentucky, listening on WFIA. Ethan, go right ahead.
Yeah, hi, Dr. Mohler. I just heard you talking about sexual abstinence and wanted to call in. I'm actually married now. My wife and I have been married for a little over 10 months, and we did something that a lot of couples aren't doing nowadays, and we didn't kiss or do anything sexual until the altar. And we've really seen the effects of that, not only in our dating relationship, but now in our marriage and the benefits of that.
Ethan, I really appreciate that testimony. Again, I'm going to ask you the same question I asked Aaron. Where'd you come up with this?
Well, a lot of the influence came from the Song of Solomon series done by Tommy Nelson. I went to the University of Kentucky, and through one of the ministries there, I was exposed to that, and really, you know, loved what Pastor Nelson had to say. And so I just kind of had these ideas in my head for a while, and then when I met my wife, you know, I just presented her with that, and, you know, wanting to not only flee sexual immorality but honor God in our relationship and be an example.
Well, God bless you, Ethan. That's a really encouraging call. Hang with me a minute. I want to ask you something. You know, when you read this article that I'm talking about in Rolling Stone magazine, it has to define what sexual abstinence is because it's writing to people who, frankly, can't even imagine what it is. It's like the word's not even in the dictionary. But I think they do a pretty accurate job. But you talk about not holding hands. Now, let me ask you a question, because there are some in the contemporary age we live in who would say that sexual abstinence is just not having sexual intercourse, but other things are legitimate. You're saying that's not true. Am I hearing you right?
Yeah, absolutely. No, it wasn't that we didn't hold hands. I mean, we held hands and we would hug, but we'd be mindful of where we're doing it. I mean, you know, I think back to you know, back in Jesus' time when, you know, before Christ came, you had the Ten Commandments, and, you know, a lot of the Jews would go down that list and say, you know, okay, well, I haven't murdered, I haven't done this, I haven't done this. But then on the Sermon on the Mount, Christ expanded that and went and said, you know, if you've even been angry with your brother, you know, in your heart,
that's right,
and you've committed murder, and if you've looked at a woman lustfully, you know, you've committed adultery. And so we kind of just looked at sexual morality as a cliff, and we wanted to see how far away we could stay from the cliff and avoid danger rather than seeing how close we could get to kind of feel that, you know, rush.
Ethan, that is a great metaphor, and God bless you for calling. I think a lot of folks will be helped by just hearing that. There are a lot of folks who want to dance on the edge of the cliff rather than stay away from it. This is the Albert Mueller Program. The issue is sexual abstinence. The phone number is 877-893-8255, and we'll be back with your calls right after this. Welcome back to the Albert Mueller Program. It is always fascinating to kind of look at the mainstream media and see what their interests are. And sex is often right there at the forefront. Certainly with Rolling Stone magazine, this particular issue, you've got sex selling from the very photograph on the cover. But it's kind of unsex on the inside, waiting for sex, that becomes the fascinating story that's the counterpoint to the picture on the front. Young Christian men who are saying they're not going to have sex until marriage, and they consider it a radical exercise of Christian discipleship. And yet they also recognize that it is hardly a new idea, and it's not some program that the, quote, new Christian right came up with. It's something that's right there in the Bible. Let's go to Aaron. This is another Aaron calling from Louisville, Kentucky, listening on WFIA. Aaron, go right ahead.
Good evening, Dr. Mueller.
Glad to hear from you. What do you think of all this, Aaron?
Well, one thing always struck me was that over and above the scriptural injunction to maintain that purity, it always seemed to me that to participate in the sexuality that our society has defined was to make sex very commonplace, you know, almost like washing your clothes, so to speak. And, you know, everybody's talking about marriage and the desire to have a great marriage. Well, how can you have a great marriage if you're taking the centerpiece of marriage and making it commonplace?
You know, it's interesting you say that, Aaron, because there is a young woman who's quoted in this article who's not a Christian and is not a part of this movement, who says to her, sex is just like food. It's just something that reflects a physical drive and what she defines as a physical need, and it's just like food. And, you know, just like you wouldn't talk about just abstaining from food, she says you don't talk about abstaining from sex. You know, I had the same thought you had, Aaron. You know, anyone who thinks that sex is just like food doesn't understand either sex or food, that's for certain. And I appreciate your call. I mean, it's not just like these who are committed to sexual abstinence have gone on a sex diet. There's a moral issue involved here. Appreciate your call, Aaron. Let's go to Rob, listening on XM Satellite Radio, calling from Seattle, Washington. Rob, go right ahead.
Hey, how you doing? I'm just calling. It seems like you had a couple callers who said that they waited to do anything, kiss, hold hands until they were married. And I just think that, you know, writers like Joshua Harris and things have blown that out of proportion. I personally know a girl who tried to do something like that, and it was very detrimental to not only any relationship she tried to have, but eventually to her relationship with God. Because it seems like you deny some things that are built within humans. You know, we're built to want to have physical relationships with each other. And I do think that we need to abstain as Christians until marriage, but we also need to rightly evaluate where we are with the person.
All right, Rob, hang with me here for a minute. Let me just say, in the interest of full disclosure here, Josh Harris is a good friend of mine, and I think the point he's trying to make is that if you don't have limits, boundaries that you set ahead of time, you're going to be constantly renegotiating the ground when it comes to sexual contact, physical contact, and all the rest. I am not saying that I think that the gold standard that I would, on biblical grounds, hold out is no kissing until marriage, until, you know, sometimes you have these couples who say this is our first kiss. I think that's a beautiful thing, but I don't think it's biblically mandated. But I would say this. I think kissing that turns into a passionate, eroticizing kiss is something that's, well, to use the metaphor we've already confronted, dancing real close to the edge of that cliff. Rob, help us out here. How do you see the responsibility to set these standards? You know, if you're rejecting what you heard before, what would you put in its place?
Yeah, well, I wasn't trying to deny or bash Josh Harris at all. I think that was just taken out of proportion by a lot of people.
Uh-huh.
I think in place, the older Christians, the elders of the church, need to be mentoring the younger men and the women mentoring the younger women so that we can rightly evaluate ourselves and where we can be comfortable with our, you know, fiancé or boyfriend or girlfriend, you know. If you're 15, you have a boyfriend and girlfriend, definitely making out, not a good time. You should limit the amount of times that you kiss and you hug and how much physical affection you have. But like myself, I'm 24 and I have a fiancé, and we've sat down and discovered and said, well, this is where we feel comfortable with each other, and we know that within these boundaries, we're not going to go any farther. And that's with the help of elders of the church. And I think that, you know, as I grow up, I hope to mentor other young men to rightly evaluate themselves.
Yeah, well, Rob, I'm right with you on the mentoring side, but, you know, when it comes to the boundaries, you know, I'm not sure exactly where you left us, but I'm going to make some assumptions, and I think we've lost Rob, and I can't go back to him. But you know, one of the assumptions that I would make there is that the boundaries you're talking about means no sexual contact. I think that's what's very important. But by the time you're inside clothing, you're inside the danger zone. Let's just put it that way. If you're inside clothing, and where clothing ought to be, you are inside the danger zone by definition. Now, you know, there are other couples just in terms of holding hands and hugs and kisses and all the rest. You know, I don't have a proof text in Scripture to which I can say here is the clear boundary. I can say what I've tried to hold out before, and that is that the dating scene allows far too much time alone for couples anyway. And Rob and his fiancé are in a situation where they're obviously headed for marriage, and I pray God's blessings to them. And Rob, I pray that you and your fiancé arrive at that wedding day and that wedding ceremony pure, and there that you'll receive all the gifts that God would give you, which will go far beyond your imagination in terms of all the gifts of marriage, from intimacy and, yes, the physical relationship to all the joys and responsibilities that just come from the institution that God made for a man and woman together. All right. This discussion has been absolutely fascinating. You know, I think when we're talking about a countercultural message, we've heard a lot of it today. We've had several different voices on this program. And I think it's interesting that all the voices we had were young male voices. That ought to tell you something. There are a lot of young Christian men out there who are committed to sexual abstinence. There are a lot of young men out there, young Christian men, who really are, as the author of this article indicated, like young Christian knights. And I really appreciate what Rob had to say about mentoring, older Christian men mentoring younger Christian men. But I also think that on this score, there are some younger Christian men who are teaching older Christian men a thing or two as well about recovering sexual abstinence and understanding of biblical sexuality and the ideal and standard of sexual purity. And that is an entirely good thing. The idea of sexual abstinence isn't new. Let's just make that clear. It isn't new. But it needs to be newly recovered. This cover story in Rolling Stone magazine is one indication that we may be seeing that kind of recovery, not in the larger culture, but among very seriously minded, seriously committed young Christians, young men and women who share this commitment. I don't know how many of you would ever see this magazine, and frankly, I wouldn't commend it. But about this message, it's too important to leave alone. We've talked about it on this program before. We'll return to this theme again. It's important that we be reminded from time to time exactly why we understand that it is God who gets to define our sexuality. Live from Louisville, Kentucky, I'm Albert Mohler. Welcome back to the Albert Mohler Program. We are the inhabitants of a counterculture. As a matter of fact, when it comes to sexuality, the culture war, issues of life and death, human dignity, and moral relativism, we're standing on a completely different ground than those who inhabit the secular culture. And these days, you know, I've been referring to these young guys profiled in this Rolling Stone article as being seriously minded Christians. Well, I have to tell you, I think that's going to be all that we have left. It's going to take seriously minded Christians to be Christian. It's going to take seriously committed Christians to be Christian and to demonstrate what Christianity is before a watching world. The terms of our warfare, of our spiritual discipleship, have really changed in recent years, and so have some of the challenges. Human sexuality is a constant in terms of challenge, but the terrain of our contemporary challenge, especially for young people, is really a rocky road, and that's why I think we need to give young people all the resources we can give. My wife and I dated, and we were engaged and got married in 1983, and we were committed to sexual abstinence until we were married, and I'm very thankful for that. But, you know, all we really had was the knowledge that the Bible said sex should be reserved for marriage. And we had a supportive church culture that just expected young people to wait until sex for marriage. There wasn't much writing on the topic. No one was really talking about this. We didn't have the kinds of resources that are out there today. We didn't have the Joshua Harrises and the others who were talking about this. We didn't have the books. We didn't have the accountability process and all the rest that Christians have really devised in recent years in recovering this ideal of sexual abstinence and sexual purity, aiming for God's maximum in marriage. And so I think there are great challenges facing this generation, but I also want to encourage you. You've got some significant resources out there, resources that are available to you that will help you as you think these issues through, as you hold yourself accountable to God's word, and as you try to think through the issues of the day. I put up some resources all the time on my website at albertmuller.com. I write about this in my weblog and in the commentaries. We talk about it on the program because this is not an issue you can just talk about once or twice a year and just let go and just hope that others will remember. It's the kind of issue that is constantly needing affirmation, rethinking, reaffirmation. It's where Christians need to learn how comfortably to talk about these things in order that we do not allow the world to do all the talking. Let's not fool ourselves. The world has a message. It's very eloquent and articulate and very effective in getting that message out. We need to be there for our own young people with a message that is more compelling, more truthful, more authoritative, more applicable, more understandable, and by God's grace, a lot more powerful. Thanks for listening today to the Albert Mohler Program. You'll want to go to the weblog and commentary at www.albertmohler.com. And we'll be back tomorrow for Intelligent Christian Conversation. See you then.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit our website, www.albertmohler.com. You'll find archives of past shows, Dr. Mohler's daily crosswalk commentary, and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmohler.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter.